Hello, and welcome to this week's Ukraine Calling program. I'm Bohdan Nahailo for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv. We'll have a roundup of the weekly news for you, an in-depth interview with the representative of the UN High Commissioner for Refugees in Ukraine, a cultural section, and some music. But first, as always, the news.
This video, posted on social media by Crimean Tatars, shows Russian police arriving to conduct a house search in a village near Simferopol.
The Member of Parliament gives the signal, and Agent Katerina, here pixelated, crosses the restaurant. The politician believes she is a businesswoman based in the United Arab Emirates.
Introduce Volodymyr Kulik, who is here from the Institute of Political and Ethnic Studies of the National Academy of Sciences of Ukraine. His research fields include politics of language and memory, identity in contemporary Ukraine.
The number of ceasefire violations recorded by the OSCE Special Monitoring Mission rose by some 55% in comparison with the previous week.
Extreme heat advisory in Ukraine. Ukraine remains in the grips of the, quote, Lucifer, unquote, heat wave that's blanketing Eastern Europe. Although not as bad as it is in some countries, the capital Kyiv had a high of 37 degrees Celsius on Friday, the 11th of August, well above the seasonal average. And in Crimea, four Crimean Tatars were detained. Hromadske Radio and other media outlets reported that on the 10th of August, four Crimean Tatars were detained in Novoklenkove village, Bilohirsk region of the Russian-occupied peninsula. Few details are available at present, but lawyer Emil Kurbedinov told Hromadske Radio that the home of a Crimean Tatar family was searched by Russian authorities. After that, four men were removed and taken to an unknown location. According to Kurbedinov, the four men were relatives. Four women and at least four children remained in the house. And MPs have been accused of illegal amber mining and were in court again. A high-profile corruption case was in the courts this week again. It's significant because it's two members of parliament who sit with the governing coalition, Maxim Polyakov and Borislav Rozenblat, who are being charged by the National Anti-Corruption Bureau, NABU, with illegal mining of amber, a very lucrative black market business. The case was brought against, was brought before Kyiv's Solominsky court on Tuesday, the 8th of August, and according to the news agency Union, the trial is a heated one. And now it seems clear again that Ukrainians prefer Ukrainian, not Russian, language media. A study conducted by political scientist Dr. Volodymyr Kulik of Ukraine's National Academy of Sciences, using the resources of the Kyiv International Institute of Sociology, shows that over the past 5 years, Ukrainian audiences have shifted their preferences from Russian language media content to Ukrainian language. This is in all forms of media, newspapers, television, information and entertainment, the internet and films. And we'll post a link to a report about the study on our website. And the war continues. The intensity of the conflict did not abate during the last week. Pro-Russian forces reportedly used mortars and artillery against Ukrainian units on different areas of the front line. On the 8th of August, the commander of Ukrainian armed forces, General Murzhenko, said Russia has been forming offensive forces on the territories close to the Ukrainian border. Meanwhile, on the 9th of August, journalist Andriy Saplenko reported a massive relocation of military equipment on Russian territory in the direction of Ukrainian borders. During the last week, four Ukrainian servicemen were killed in action and 20 wounded. Well, I have great pleasure today in welcoming this week's guest, Pablo Mateu, who is the representative of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees in Ukraine. I'm particularly pleased because I'm a former UNHCR employee myself, spent 20 years with the organization, and had the privilege of working alongside Pablo, who still is with the organization. He has served in many, many countries, and it's indeed fortunate for Ukraine at this time of misfortune to have such a experienced and seasoned UNHCR manager, campaigner, and humanitarian. So welcome to the program, Pablo.
Thank you so much, Bogdan, and thank you for having me here.
Look, I'm not going to assume that all of our listeners know all the legal aspects of defending refugees and IDPs, or even perhaps are up to date with the scale of the humanitarian challenges in this country. So in these 20 minutes or so, let's try and put things in perspective. Let's begin by asking, how many internally displaced persons does UNHCR have on its books at the moment in Ukraine?
Okay, the Ministry of Social Policy in Ukraine registers internally displaced. And according to their latest statistics, there's about 1.6 million internally displaced persons registered.
Which is a large figure. It's certainly up to the standards of, what, former Yugoslavia conflicts in the 80s?
Indeed. For a country of 43 million, I think it's quite a large percentage of the population. And we have to keep in mind that some people who are displaced have decided not to register.
Yes. And tell us, are these displaced just in Ukraine? Russia claims a large number are displaced there. Belarus also claims it has refugees.
That figure, 1.6 million, entails only those Ukrainians who have decided to remain within the territory of Ukraine. We have significant numbers of Ukrainians who have gone abroad. They haven't all asked for asylum. Many of them have also looked for alternative forms of residency. If we take, for example, Belarus, they have about 2,000 Ukrainians who are recognized as refugees. But they have about 250,000 Ukrainians who have a different form of residency, which has been granted by the Belarusian government. Poland has taken a similar approach. In other words, those who have been recognized as refugees are very few, but they have decided to grant different types of migratory status to quite a few thousand Ukrainians.
But tell me, so this would appear to suggest that there are, what, about 2 million displaced from eastern Ukraine? And if you could just explain to our listeners also, clearly they have material needs, they have social needs, but they also are in need of certain legal protection.
Correct. When we discuss with IDPs, and if we look at some of the surveys conducted, for example, by the World Bank or by the International Organization for Migration, there are two concerns that come at the top of the displaced list of problems. One is housing. You know, many of them are struggling to find affordable housing. And the second one is employment. But also on the list of problems is legal issues. For example, being able to legalize a small business, you know, when sometimes their internal document says that they are residents of a different province, right? Some of the children who are currently born in those areas which are not currently controlled by the government of Ukraine, registering them as Ukrainian citizens can be problematic. There is a process established by law, but that process has quite a few requirements that some families are not always able to meet.
I'm just reminding listeners that I'm talking to Pablo Mateu, the UNHCR High Commissioner for Refugees of the UN representative in Ukraine. Tell me a little bit more now about what the government has actually done. How well has it coped in dealing with this unexpected and large challenge in recent years?
A lot of people highlight the initial response to the displacement crisis, particularly by civil society. And we have to recognize that. We have to recognize that civil society in Ukraine were the first respondents. But we also have to admit that the regional and municipal authorities also reacted quite quickly. And we also have to recognize that the central government in Ukraine took very positive steps from the very beginning. Let me just give you three examples. First, they refused to establish IDP camps. There were some...
What is the significance of that? It's not apparent to all.
Okay, when you establish camps, either for refugees or for IDPs, you are basically isolating them. There's quite a lot of social problems that come with it. Sometimes you can create ghettos. Instead, the government refused the pressure from some organizations to establish the camps, and they decided that the displaced should integrate communities. That was a very positive move. Second, they passed legislation related to internal displacement. The legislation is not perfect, but it incorporates some of the international standards and principles. So that's also a very positive measure taken by the central government. And third, they created a dedicated ministry in 2016 to look after not just the internally displaced, but also those territories that are temporarily, the title of the ministry is Ministry for Temporarily Occupied Territories and Internally Displaced. This happened much faster than in Georgia, for example, where there is also a dedicated ministry. Now, does this mean that everything is perfect? Obviously not.
But in real practical terms, how is the government assisting them apart from allowing them to settle in other areas? Are these unfortunate people victims of this conflict? Are they receiving material assistance? Are they receiving social assistance? Are they receiving assistance with finding employment, though it's difficult to find, as you've said?
I think they are. You know, a lot of times we give quite a lot of recognition to the international organizations or to the NGOs that are supporting the displaced. But the government has actually also established certain measures and certain programs to support them. There is a decree that stipulates a monthly payment to the internally displaced. Let's say that in real terms it's not a lot, but if you add it up, if you know it's 1.6 million people who are receiving that particular stipend. So that's like a cash grant, and they can use it for, you know, any type of need that they have.
And in terms of the geography of this displacement, are the bulk of the IDPs, the internally displaced persons, still in eastern Ukraine, or are they scattered fairly evenly over the country?
I think most of them decided to stay close to their original places of origin. So that means eastern Ukraine, the five provinces that we consider to be eastern Ukraine. But many also came to the capital. Obviously, that's where a lot of the employment opportunities are. And some of them went to western Ukraine also. So provinces like Odessa and Kherson also have significant numbers of the displaced. But still, the bulk is in eastern Ukraine.
Now, tell me a little bit about UNHCR's activities and work. First, let's clarify one thing. You represent the High Commissioner for Refugees, yet you're dealing with IDPs.
Correct.
Does this mean that in practice, UNHCR is now recognized as a lead agency also in this sphere by default?
Okay. As you rightly pointed out, UNHCR is the UN refugee agency. So we deal with persons who come to Ukraine and look for refuge or asylum here. That's our main mandate. And this is what we were working on when we established an office more than 23 years ago here in Ukraine. We're still working on that issue, and we are still supporting the government of Ukraine.
Could I just ask you in passing, give us an idea of how many recognized refugees or those recognized by the government there are at this moment in Ukraine?
At this moment, there are slightly over 3,000 recognized refugees. They come from more than 70 countries, but the largest numbers are from Afghanistan, from Syria, and then also from former Soviet republics, including the Russian Federation. So those are the recognized refugees. There's also more than 5,000 asylum seekers. These are people who are still in the asylum process at different stages. They come from very similar countries also.
And who deals with refugee status determination in the government system now? Because it has changed over the years, I remember.
The first instance is obviously the State Migration Service. They are the ones who conduct the procedure or the process that will determine who is a refugee. But then if the decision of the State Migration Service is negative, then they go to different courts. So there's a checks and balances system established here. The State Border Guard Services, they also play a role because, you know, in order to have access to the territory of Ukraine, they have to go through the State Border Guards system, either at the airport or at land border or land crossing points.
How many people do you have here in place, international and national auxiliaries, to deal with this challenge?
Mm-hmm. In the case of UNHCR, we have 8 offices in the country. 7 are located in the eastern provinces, 2 in non-government and controlled areas. And we have 127 staff. The great majority are Ukrainian nationals. We only have 23 international staff members.
And who are your main partners? Who are your main allies in this undertaking, both international and local?
Okay. We are implementing our program through 15 partners. They're mostly non-governmental organizations. Only 2 are international NGOs. The rest are national entities. We are also working very closely with the newly established ministry, the Ministry for Temporarily Occupied Territories and Internally Displaced Persons. We are also working very closely with municipalities. The municipality of Mariupol is very active in trying to support and integrate internally displaced persons. Lviv has also done quite a lot of work, but also some of the smaller municipalities. Outside of Kiev, there is a town called Irpen. They have been very active in trying to support those who have decided to come from eastern Ukraine and find safe places.
I'm talking to Pablo Mateo, the representative of the High Commissioner of the UN for Refugees in Ukraine. Let's just conclude now by trying to take stock of the costs of this huge undertaking to address these humanitarian challenges and relief efforts, legal challenges and everything else. You have led the attempts to raise money from donors. What estimates have you put out most recently, and how much has the country actually received?
Okay, this year's budget alone is $38 million. Now, that's just for UNHCR. Imagine when you start adding up all the different UN agencies, the International Committee of the Red Cross, Caritas. You know, the Pope had this quite generous appeal for Ukraine. The international NGOs, the national NGOs, which have been quite efficient, I have to say, in raising funds from the Ukrainian diaspora and from supporters of Ukraine, particularly in Europe and in North America, it's a lot of money. And it's a lot of money. And unfortunately, as the attention of the international community goes to other places like Yemen or South Sudan, then, you know, the attention is no longer on Ukraine. So the humanitarian support is going down.
Do you sense what we used to call compassion fatigue for Ukraine? Because it's a many people see it as a frozen conflict that's off the radar screen. The international radar screen pops up from time to time. So it's not seen as something that's as acute as maybe other issues.
Right. And unfortunately, I think this is a wrong description of the conflict. The recently appointed U.S. Special Representative for Ukraine, Ambassador Kurt Volker, he described it not as a frozen conflict when he recently visited the contact line in eastern Ukraine. He said this is a very hot conflict. Despite that, the attention, like I said, is drifting away from Ukraine. So part of our responsibility is to make sure that people around the world realize that there are still outstanding humanitarian needs.
As a result of this perhaps lack of focus or attention, what is how much have you actually managed to raise out of that $37 million that you needed?
Well, you know, like I said, unfortunately, the humanitarian donors are concentrating on other crises. We've been managed to raise almost $12 million out of the 38.
Who are the main donors at this stage, say in the last year or two?
I think, you know, the main donors are the ones that are also supporting Ukraine in other aspects, including its program of reforms. You have the United States, you have Canada, you have the European Union, and then you have individual members of the European Union, such as Germany, Norway, Sweden, Denmark. Switzerland is also a big donor, not to UNHCR, but, for example, to the International Committee of the Red Cross. And, of course, Japan. Japan has steadily supported not just the humanitarian agencies, but also development agencies.
Of course, at the moment, there seems to be no end in sight to this war, to this conflict. But one day, obviously, things will have to change. UNHCR will be preparing also for contingencies for return, peace building, rebuilding, etc. How is that already figuring in your planning?
Okay, we have now prepared a multi-year, multi-partner protection and solutions strategy for the next 5 years. The solutions aspect of it is emphasized because, as you rightly said, some people are coming back and more people will probably come back in the future, even if the conflict is still ongoing. Unfortunately, there seems to be no end to the conflict for the time being. But you never know. We need to be prepared for an eventual peaceful settlement and return of the displaced.
Thank you very much. I've been honored to have as my guest this week Pablo Mateo, the High Commissioner for Refugees representative in Ukraine. Thanks so much, Pablo.
Thank you, Bogdan.
And now for culture. There's a cool interactive exhibit in Kyiv's Boryspil International Airport. Ukraine's National Post Office invites passengers waiting for their flights to send postcards from Ukraine to their loved ones anywhere in the world and offers to pick up the tab for postage. Free postcards featuring classic Ukrainian paintings are available for free, and you can drop them in your choice of an old mailbox decorated by a contemporary artist. And now on to music. This week's song is by Margot Hontar. Some of you might be thinking, wait, I know that name. You've heard Margot giving an interview to Ukraine calling about the Stop Fake project she founded last autumn. But she's also a musician, and this is a song from her latest album with her new band called Anakart. That's an abbreviated version of the Latin word for cashew. The song is called Misto, which means city. Imagine your favorite city while you listen and enjoy.
можливо, сьогодні це той самий момент, якого я чекала так довго. Це місто, це небо, це все, що мені треба сьогодні. Дихаю солодке повітря п'яне. Іноді здається менше, але це той самий момент, коли це неважливо, це все неважливо, це місто, це небо, це все, що мені треба сьогодні. Я дихаю солодке повітря п'яне. І на цю безкінечну мить це все, що треба сьогодні. Це місто, це небо, це все, що мені треба сьогодні. Дихаю солодке повітря п'яне. І на цю безкінечну мить це все, що треба сьогодні.
And looking forward, tune in again next week for a new edition of Ukraine Calling. We would be happy to receive any feedback from you, and you can contact us by writing to our email address on our website. This is Bohdan Nahailo in Kyiv. Thanks so much for listening.